about the class of surface singularities called rational double points. And these can be approached from a number of different directions. But what I want to look at is starting with a K3 surface. Actually, these singularities are more local in nature, so we could start with something which locally looked like a K3 surface, but I'd rather not get into the technical complications of that. So in particular, it's something whose canonical bundle is identically zero. It's zero as a divisor. There exists a nowhere-vanishing holomorphic two-form in the language that I was using last week. Now, I'm going to assume that I've got a collection of irreducible curves on this surface. So these are complex surfaces and complex curves, which the union of whose points is a connected subset. So this is supposed to be connected. And I'm hoping that this will collapse to a single singular point. So this entire collection of curves, whatever it is going to collapse to one singular point, P. And there's a criterion due to Mumford from the early 60s for such a collapse. And that is that the intersection matrix, the matrix of Ci dot Cj's, needs to be negative definite. So these are distinct curves. The off-diagonal entries in this matrix will be positive, but not negative anyway. They count the number of intersection points counted with multiplicities according to whether things are tangent and so on. The diagonal elements count the so-called self-intersections of the curves, and those are just the degrees of the normal bundles. And so those all have to be negative in particular in order to get a negative definite intersection matrix. Now, the essential algebraic geometry that we reviewed last week included the adjunction formula, which tells me that the canonical bundle on this canonical divisor on this curve C can be described in terms of the canonical divisor of the surface S restricted to C plus the normal bundle C restricted to C. And if I calculate degrees of these things, the degree of the canonical bundle of an algebraic curve, a Riemann surface, was 2G minus 2. It was just directly given by the topological invariant. On the other hand, since Ks is 0, this term gives me 0, and this is what I was just calling C dot C. It's the degree of the normal bundle. So the first conclusion that we draw is that in order to have a negative definite intersection matrix, in particular, all of the components have to have genus 0. And in fact, the self-intersections of the irreducible components will be minus 2, whereas the intersections between different components in this connected set will be non-negative. So now there's a little combinatorial problem. Which is classify all negative definite matrices, symmetric matrices, with integer entries and this property that Ci squared is minus 2 and Ci dot Cj is greater than or equal to 0 for I not equal to j. And the solution to the combinatorial problem is given by simply laced Dinkin diagrams. Well, I should say Cartan matrices of simply laced Dinkin diagrams minus Cartan matrices, since in this context the matrix is supposed to be positive definite. So minus Cartan matrices of simply laced Dinkin diagrams. So in particular, they've got names A and N, so I'll call it AN minus 1, DN, E67, and E8. This DN exists for N at least 4. And this gives a classification of all such configurations of curves that you might hope to shrink to a singular point. So we're expecting to see things like this in a global sense on K3 surfaces. There are other conditions, by the way, to be embedded on a K3 surface. In particular, the number of curves will be bounded by 19 at most, if we're going to be able to embed it on a K3 surface. But in a slightly more local context, we can imagine a local thing which looks like a K3 surface in the sense that it has a trivial canonical bundle, and then the same trivial canonical divisor, and then the same analysis goes through and gives this list of singularities. Now, I don't have time to explain to you how you start from this slightly abstract discussion of curves contracting to a point and determine the equations, but all of these singularities are hypersurfaces. Hypersurface singularities. They depend on no parameters. So just getting the configuration of the graph turns out to be enough to determine the isomorphism type of the singularities. And the equations have been worked out, and I'll make a little chart of them for you. Sure. The problem is I've got a small piece of chalk, which has a bad psychological effect. There's a bigger one. I'm sorry. All that means is that it's going to be described by a single equation, f of xyz equals 0, locally, inside C3, where this will have an isolated singularity at the origin. By what? No parameters. There's a unique isomorphism type of singularity for a given graph. In this case, there are other kinds of singularities which you might study using the same techniques of trying to study the graph and the intersection matrix. The way that parameters can enter is, well, let's see. First of all, the curves might have higher genus, and then you have to worry about what the curve is. You might have a curve that meets four other curves, and then the cross ratio of the intersection points would be a parameter, for example. But if you know your classification of Dakin diagrams, you know that that doesn't happen here. And it turns out that the actual isomorphism type is unique. So here they are. This is the type. And then I'll give the equation. So a n minus 1, d n for n at least 4, e6, 7, and e8. This is x, y plus z to the n. This one is, I don't have them memorized, sorry. You would think I would know them after all these years. But this is x squared plus y squared z plus z to the n minus 1, theta equals 0, as I said, equation. This is x squared plus y cubed plus z to the 4th equals 0. Here I have x squared plus y cubed plus yz cubed is equal to 0. And here it's x squared plus y cubed plus z to the 5th is equal to 0. So when I say that this is the equation, of course, there are obviously change of variables you could make to put the equation into a different form. What I'm asserting is that any time you contract this configuration of curves, there is some change of variables which would put the equation into this form. Now, I also told you that an apparent coincidence, there's another description of these things, which is related to subgroups of SU2, finite subgroups of SU2. And this is another approach to trying to classify the singularities. But it's only, you know, that from the point of view that we were describing of limiting metrics on K3 manifolds, where these things are shrinking to 0, that really suggests this as the way to start classifying these things. And then it's only sort of an accident that you find out that it's either described by precisely this list of hypersurfaces or by some kind of orbifold. But no. Well, these can, but these cannot. 3 out of 5. Two of which are incident sets, so never mind. Yes. Little k. Little k is the rank. Not the rank. The size of that matrix. It's a k by k matrix. K was n minus 1 or n or 6 or 7 or 8. That's. For a K3 surface, it can't be bigger than 19. But if I make a local K3 surface, if I'm working with ALE spaces instead of K3 surfaces, which are very similar things, then I would end up with this story. The groups are a cyclic group of order n in this case. Well, we have to remember that the most familiar forms of these groups are actually the ones embedded in SO3, which is SC2 mod the center. And there they form rotation groups which can be described as symmetries of space figures of various kinds. But when you lift up to SU2, nothing unusual happens in this case of ZN, but in the other cases you get a central extension by Z2 of what's the slightly more familiar group. So here I'll get something called the binary dihedral group of order 4N, which is a central extension, it's a Z2 extension, of the dihedral group of order 2N, and that D must not be confused with this D, which is another good reason for using the binary dihedral groups. I should use a different font, but I don't have any font at my disposal. Here I get the binary tetrahedral group, which is symmetry. So this was symmetries of a polygon with n sides, including reflections as well as rotations. This is symmetries of a tetrahedron. This is symmetries of an octahedron or a cube, the binary octahedral group. And the binary icosahedral group is symmetries of either a dodecahedron or an icosahedron. So the 5 regular platonic solids have 3 distinct symmetry groups, and their Z2 extensions are showing up here as groups corresponding to these singularities. Now, one of the important properties that... Oh, yeah, so I was going to show you how this works in the case of AN minus 1. If I want to write the singularity as C2 mod G with the ZN action, in coordinates UV, UV would go to e to the 2 pi I over N. This is a generator for the group action. E to the 2 pi I over N U, e to the minus 2 pi I over N V. And the obvious invariants here are X, which is minus U to the N, Y, which is V to the N, and Z, which is UV. And with those choices, the equation that relates these is XY plus Z to the N is equal to 0. So I reproduce the hypersurface by studying invariants of these finite groups. And you can get these equations by studying invariant theory for these finite subgroups of SU2 in the natural two-dimensional representation, finding that the invariants are generated by 3 fundamental invariants with 1 algebraic relation, which, if you choose the basis correctly, can be put into this form. So the story I want to tell you briefly is the theory of simultaneous resolution of these rational double points. Well, first of all, what are the deformations of the rational double points? I'll illustrate this with an example. I'm interested in the deformations as a singularity, and I don't want to try to set up the formal terms in which this is done, but in fact, to try to study only the local behavior, you have to introduce what are called germs and look at the germ of this thing. If you don't know what that is, that's okay. What you're looking for is lower order perturbations of this polynomial. And the reason lower order suffices is if you had terms that had the same degree or higher in these various variables, you'd be able to make a change of coordinates to just absorb those higher degree terms with a redefinition, local redefinition of the holomorphic coordinate. So what's crucial is lower degree terms, and in fact, there's no need to consider any x and y terms at all. Moreover, you don't need a z to the n minus 1 term by a well-known algebraic trick in which you can complete the nth power, as it were, and omit a z to the n minus 1 term from such a deformation just by a simple change of coordinates. So the essential parameters turn out to depend on z to the n minus 2 with some coefficient, z to the n minus 3 with some coefficient, down finally to Sn. And these S2, S3, up to Sn span, these are coordinates on what's known as the versal deformation space, which is just some technical term that tells us that we're describing the essential local deformations of this singularity, isolating it from whatever might be going on globally on the K3 surface. Now, there's a pretty natural algebraic thing to try to do with such an equation, which is to take the nth degree equation and factor it. So if I were able to write this as z plus t1, z plus t2, up to z plus tn, well, there would be a constraint here. T1 plus T2 up to Tn has to be 0. That was the choice I made to leave out the n minus 1 term. But aside from that, the Sj would now be the jth elementary symmetric function of the T1 through Tn with S1 set equal to 0. And this particular form of the equation has this very pleasant property of simultaneous resolution that I'll describe in just a moment. So what I've really done is I've taken this space S, which had coordinates S2 through Sn, and I've introduced these Ts, T1 through Tn, which don't quite span the space S. There's, in fact, a finite covering map between the space spanned by the Ts and the space spanned by the Ss, which is given by the action of the symmetric group. So this is actually T mod Sn, T mod the symmetric group. And the fact that we get both smooth spaces both on T and on S is a fairly well-known algebraic fact that the invariant polynomials under the symmetric group, under the standard action of the symmetric group, are themselves a free polynomial ring. So I did exactly that when I wrote down something like xy equals z squared minus lambda squared last time. This was the case of A1. I was putting in the deformation parameter, and if I put it in as mu, if I'd started out with z squared minus mu, that would have been the versal deformation. That would have described all the local deformations. When I use a lambda squared instead of a mu, I was then able to exploit, so that's this change from the space S to the space T, I was able to exploit the factorization to do a blow-up. And the thing that I did when I did a blow-up was I blew up, well, I used this as a coordinate in P1, thereby effectively blowing up the intersection of x equals 0 with z plus lambda equals 0. And I can pull a similar trick here now that I have the equation in this kind of factored form. So the basic thing that you do is you consider x and z plus t1 to be in P1. Actually, I need to do a number of them. I have to sort of use all, or perhaps all but one of the factors in the course of doing this. So maybe P1 to the n minus 1. Blowing up a number of curves sitting on this surface, which at smooth points does not affect the singularities, but at singular points will actually resolve or partially resolve the singularities. And the upshot of this entire calculation is that there is a smooth family of surfaces, script X, sitting over S, which maps to a family of surfaces, script Y, sitting over, sitting over S. And the fibers here are, so X of T is a resolution of singularities of Y sub, we call this alpha T, for all T. So the singularities get better. If you take generic values of the t's, there won't be any singularities at all. It's only when some of the t's coincide that you actually get singularities in this picture. But all those singularities, are, no matter how precisely how singular it is, exactly that much of the singularity is resolved by this construction. Well, that was the an minus 1 case. And if you're aware of the Dinkin diagram connection, and you see an Sn floating around, you might think file group. And that's, in fact, the general construction. So the general construction has T mapping to S. So, I should say that T is actually the complexification of the Cartan subalgebra for the corresponding real Lie algebra, or it's the Cartan subalgebra for the complex semi-simple group associated to this thing. Yes. Yeah. Well, I was blowing it up. So, yeah, so last time I had R form on Z2, which was a cone like this, and I blew it up to get this kind of guy. But, okay. Okay. Let me leave the realm of K3s for just a moment. So if I leave the realm of K3s and go into higher dimension, then the distinction between two ways of smoothing out a singularity is a little bit more apparent. So there are two things I can do. One thing that I can do is I can try to vary the parameters in the equation. And the other thing that I can do is replace the singular set with some larger set in one of these birational blow-off operations. And those are very different things if you're in dimension higher than 2. If you're in dimension 2, they still look like different things to a mathematician, but to a physicist, they don't. And the reason they don't is because you guys know that there's more supersymmetry in these problems than the complex structures suggest. These are actually hyper-Kähler manifolds. There's a whole family of complex structures. And from a complex geometer's perspective, varying the coordinates and doing a blow-up are different, but if you rotate the complex structure, those two operations can be interchanged. So for that reason, there's a lot of confusion in the physics literature about the difference between resolving and deforming. That confusion is justified in the K3 case, but it unfortunately gets extrapolated to higher dimension where it's an honest confusion. So the standard mathematical language is to refer to this process of separating the t's as a deformation, and this process of taking the closure of the graph of some rational map as a blow-up or a birational transformation, and to distinguish between those two properties. Anyway, I've got my space T, and then my space S is just T modded out by the Weyl group, and the phenomenon I mentioned about invariance polynomials under action of the symmetric group actually extends to invariant polynomials for actions of the Weyl groups for all of these groups, and you get smooth parameter spaces in both cases of the same dimension with just a small, with just this Weyl group group action distinguishing between the two, and the general picture is the same. The general picture is that there's some family whose fibers are smooth sitting over T, there's a family whose fibers generally have singularity sitting over S, and you get a simultaneous resolution when you come from one to the other. So all of that is describing locally what happens near some points in this deformation space that I was describing yesterday. We had some points that were basically labeled Z. I'm now actually keeping track of some complex structure data as well as metric data, so I won't say exactly which space I'm looking at, but we had some points which were labeled Z, and this Z locus, the Z locus will be some complicated looking locus within there when there's more than one curve around. In a small neighborhood of such a point, we're finding the blown down K3 manifolds, so the things parameterized by S, but they have this interesting property that at least if you make a finite coordinate change, just a finite cover of this thing, well, first of all, this Z set actually straightens out into a union of hyperplanes. Those are the reflection hyperplanes for the action of the group W. And secondly, there exists a family of totally non-singular K3 surfaces which can be inserted over this guy, and which describes the structure sort of from the point of view of the non-singular K3 surface. Now, we know that if we tried to follow the metrics, we would get the metrics blowing up as we approached those points, which is why we were led to considering these models. This can only be done locally. This group action, W, can be detected by its influence on the periods. So W appears as a monodromy group on the periods of the holomorphic 2 form. And the key observation is that W is finite. So there can be other kinds of monodromy when you go to other kinds of boundary points to the moduli space of metrics. But in this particular case, that we're approaching these points Z, we actually see precisely finite monodromy groups, and they turn out to be these Weyl groups. So the properties of this picture that I want to stress are that, first of all, the singularity types are determined by analyzing blowdowns. See, that's what I did in my first step here. Oops, it's gone. That's what I did in my first step with my sort of abstract collection of Cs. I imagined that these Cs were all shrinking to zero size, that I was going to be replacing that by a point, and I was working within the algebraic category to try to understand how you would replace it by a point in the algebraic category. So singularity types are determined by analyzing blowdowns on a k equals zero manifold, complex manifold. But then they turned out to have this property that they're at finite distance from the interior of the parameter space. Sorry. That sentence needs a better subject. The points in the parameter space, or the moduli space, which correspond to places where these singularities have been acquired, are at finite distance from the interior of moduli space. And there's a monodromy characterization. Finite monodromy, in this case, for that set of points. Furthermore, there's this notion of simultaneous resolution, which enables us to recover the smooth k equals zero manifold that we had sort of started the analysis with. So this is kind of a full circle of steps, and you can start in any place and say, well, maybe I'd like to know points which are at finite distance from the interior of moduli space. There's a monodromy characterization for those points. There's a simultaneous resolution theorem, and that lets us recover them as coming from a smooth k equals zero manifold, and then we can classify them by the first step. So you can sort of start anywhere in that chain of properties and sort of work your way around the circle with these rational double points. What I'm saying, what is it? So, what I neglected to mention last time, one thing I neglected to mention last time, was that there's a natural metric on this, on these moduli spaces, either the space of metrics on the K3 manifold or metrics together with complex structure, compatible complex structure. These parameter spaces themselves have natural metrics, and they're natural metrics which come from physics. But to first approximation, you can treat them just as L2 metrics on this space. So there's some natural metric. And that gives a distinction in the context of these locally symmetric spaces that I mentioned. So we have these locally symmetric spaces, and they've got cusps out at infinity someplace. But then they had these missing points, Z, which were here in the interior, which were the fixed points for reflection hyperplane. And, Z is a submanifold, not just a point. And so these are missing points from this space which are at finite distance, so that you could follow geodesics in and get there in finite time. These are boundary points which are missing, but which you would have to travel an infinite distance to reach. Yes, Robert. Yes. Yes. Actually, in this case, that's not an approximation. It's exact, because there's a lot of supersymmetry. In the next case I talk about, it's not exact. There are potential corrections. So I'd like to try to discuss canonical singularities in higher dimension along the same lines. However, whereas we had this nice combinatorial classification of canonical singularities in dimension 2, in dimension 3 and higher, we don't have such a nice classification. And there are all sorts of things which go wrong, including the existence of a sort of marvelous zoo of different examples. So we can start, however, with point number one. So let's consider now an arbitrary Calabi-Yau manifold. So consider x with kx equals 0. Maybe not compact. And we'll consider some subspace z of x. So z should be written as a union of irreducible components, the union of zi. And what we imagine trying to do is we want to contract the zi's in some fashion. Well, there's a little bit more flexibility here. Since x has arbitrary dimension, we don't really know what dimension the various zi's might have. And in particular, if they have dimension bigger than 1, complex dimension bigger than 1, there are options about how much of them to contract. So we want to contract the zi's in such a way so that each zi is mapped to a space of lower dimension, to wi of lower dimension. So in other words, what I'm doing, I'm looking for a map from my smooth space X to some singular algebraic variety Y. Here I've got a bunch of ZIs. These ZIs have images WIs, and those images are supposed to be lower dimension. That, in particular, will tell me that the volume, when I measure it with respect to a Kähler metric on X, is going to 0. Oh, well, that's the cart before the horse. Sorry. I'd like to imagine taking a family of Kähler metrics on X in which the volumes are approaching 0 and try to model that algebraically by this kind of contraction mapping. So just so that we don't get too lost in the details, let me restrict the case to x having complex dimension 3. Then there are only two possibilities. The dimension of zi, complex dimension of zi, is 1 or 2. And there are three possibilities. If the dimension of zi equals 2, then the dimension of wi can be 0 or 1. So you can have, for each of these components, you can have a curve which contracts to something of lower dimension, which is necessarily a point, or you can have a surface, and the surface can either contract to a point or a curve. Those are the three possible cases to consider. But since I'm taking a union of things, even if I take it to be connected, I might allow mixtures of those gadgets. So I might have a curve and a surface, and somehow those could contract to a curve with a specific point on it, so that this point had as its inverse image this curve together with one of the curves here, and then the rest of the curves here each had a single point as their image. So there are various complicated mixed contractions that you could imagine doing. Well, the first problem is that Mumford's contraction criterion does not generalize beyond dimension 2. So problem number one We do not have a good criterion for which these are contractible. And so the problem has usually been approached in the opposite direction. So the sort of opposite approach, sometimes called the bottom-up approach as opposed to the top-down approach, bottom-up approach says start with Y and restrict to singularities whose resolution X has KX equals 0. So I could have run through that in the rational double point situation. There are specific criteria that you can apply to singularities and kind of analyze on the basis of what terms might appear in an equation, whether or not there exists a resolution, a blow-up, with Ks equals 0. And you can read through that analysis in a lot of detail. Actually, it's a series of exercises in Reed's Young Person's Guide. Well, even this bottom-up approach has a difficulty. But problem number two, although there is a so-called minimal blow-up for any singularity in dimension 2, which is unique, so we really know what we're talking about by starting with Y and trying to recover X. We want to take the minimal blow-up. I'll explain in a minute why a non-minimal one would not have canonical bundle trivial. Although there's a minimal blow-up for any singularity in dimension 2, which is unique, this fails in dimension bigger than 2. So we have to try some kind of indirect approach to analyzing whether or not there might exist a blow-up with a trivial canonical bundle. And the first criterion, first observation is that if we blow up X further, or one might say unnecessarily. So in other words, if we accept as a fact of life that there's a tremendous amount of freedom in doing blow-ups and blow-downs in algebraic varieties, and if you're just trying to study blow-ups, you can't be sure, as you're starting to resolve the singularities of Y, that you're going to precisely arrive at the Kx equals 0 guy that you want. So suppose we blow up X further. In other words, do extra blow-ups to X. Then the observation is that Kx is some combination of new divisors that were introduced by these blow-ups with non-negative coefficients. So the EIs are new divisors. Maybe I should use a different index. New divisors from extra blow-ups. Well, that's simply the statement that if we take capital omega, which is the holomorphic end form on X, and we have a further blow-up, which is W mapping to X by pi, then pi upper star omega is a holomorphic end form on W. So all it has is zeros, no poles. So X has this very delicate property of having a nowhere vanishing holomorphic end form, and we lost that by doing further unnecessary blow-ups. Yes, thank you. Yes. If we blow up X further to W, this is KW. Thank you. No, it's greater than or equal to. It's well, Yeah, it's strict. If I just include the new device, it's from extra loss. So the somewhat indirect approach to studying these canonical singularities is to define them by using this property. So here's the definition. Y has canonical, well, I'm actually giving you a definition for a slight subclass of what are known as canonical singularities in the mathematical literature, but it's the one that's relevant here. Y has canonical Gorenstein singularities. If I don't want to get in the sheet. Give you a definition of a sheaf. So if there is a if there is a holomorphic N form defined on, so canonical Gorenstein singularities at P. So if there is a holomorphic N form defined on the smooth points of Y near P, so that's actually the definition of Gorenstein. Non-vanishing, thank you. Find on the smooth points of Y near P, and there is a blow up from W to Y, let's call it eta, such that the pullback of this holomorphic N form on Y, on the smooth points of Y near P, let me just call it omega Y, has a holomorphic extension across the exceptional set, across eta inverse of P. So, on the face of it, if you had a holomorphic N form defined near P and you pulled back, you might acquire poles along the exceptional divisor. On the other hand, if you have any hope of ever finding the X that's going to have trivial canonical bundle, there had better be no poles. We've decided that it will only have zeros in that case. So the definition that's used is to start with this nowhere vanishing holomorphic form, which is defined on all the smooth points near P, and pull that back to some blow-up and insist that it have a holomorphic extension across eta inverse of P. So it looks like a pretty severe weakening of the conditions that we were after. But it has the advantage that this is independent of the choice of W. In other words, I could insist that this is true, that this be true for all W's, or I could just insist that it be true for one W, and I would get the same class of singularities. And that makes it flexible enough so that we can actually analyze what these singularities are. Let me give one example which shows that we've slightly gone beyond what we were aiming for. The example is C4 mod Z2, where the Z2 action is by minus 1 on all coordinates. This is canonical Gorenstein. But there is no X. No blow up X with Kx equals 0. So it's a very simple singularity. It's a quotient singularity, an orbifold point. in dimension 4. But it has this nice property that the pullbacks of the holomorphic four-form that exists near the singularity, which is just the standard four-form from C4, that always extends holomorphically, but there's no actual blow-up with kx equals 0. Well, this example is actually encouraging if you're a string theorist, because string theorists realize that spaces like C4 mod Z2 are just as good as manifolds for the purposes of finding string backgrounds. And since that's the case, it sounds like even, one can hope, based on this example, that even those singularities which aren't going to be satisfying the original sort of starting condition of there being a manifold with kx equals 0 which resolves them, when they satisfy this condition, that they're going to be sensible singularities to use in string theory. So we don't know enough about this phenomenon does not happen in dimension 3. There's a reason that I had to go to dimension 4. In dimension 3, there always does exist a blow-up with kx equals 0, so that's encouraging if you're just trying to compactify string theory down to 4 dimensions. If you need to study string theory on fourfolds, which there certainly are good reasons to do, hopefully the fact that this class of canonical singularities is a little bit larger than you might have expected is not really going to be an impediment to the application. So this is the definition that, definition is in this form is due to Miles Reed from the late 70s. So we've been trying to understand these things for longer than you've needed them. On the presence of a canonical singularity, I consider it not to be conjecture in the case of the threefold because there exist Calabi-Yau resolutions in that case. But yeah, I guess I would make that as a conjecture. Why not? No. So there's this phenomenon of flops, for example. So the singularity xy equals zt, thought of now as defining a threefold in C4, has two different small resolutions. One by blowing up x equals z 0, which gives you a P1 as exceptional set. And the other by blowing up x equals t equals 0, which replaces the point by a different P1. There's a common blow up of the two of them, which was the simple blow up of the origin, which has P1 cross P1 here. But that does not have trivial canonical bundle. Right? Both of these have trivial canonical bundle, so it's not unique. That was a flop. If I have something smooth and I blow it up, it can't be Calabi-Yau. That's right. And for that, you need to know that you do get vanishing. No matter what dimension submanifold you blow up, you do get vanishing along the exceptional divisor. That's a little local computation, so you get extra vanishing. Well, let me mention some examples in dimension 3 of canonical Gorenstein singularities. First of all, we have rational double point cross disk, since I'm talking about local singularities, or cross a curve. So all of these singularities over here show up as singularities in dimension 3. They're not isolated singularities, but nobody said the singularities had to be isolated. You get a curve of singularities, and the cross-sectional singularity is one of the surface singularities that we've seen before. These are examples of canonical Gorenstein. Second kind of example you can make by studying some of these deformations. So I could take xy plus z to the n plus t z to the n minus 2, just as a simple example, or similar. Here you see at t not equal to 0, n minus 1. Here you see at t not equal to 0, you get an a n minus 2, and at t equal to 0, you get an a n minus 1. So again, I have a curve of singularities, but the singularity got worse. at one particular point and was generically an minus 2 singularity in this case. I can, but then I'll have a complicated expression with powers of t multiplying various powers of z, and it'll still be true that if z is not 0, an minus 1 is the singularity type. A third kind of example is given by a cone over a surface. So that's going to be an isolated point. And what do I mean by a cone over a surface? Well, what I imagine is that I've got a surface sitting inside of a threefold, and I'm going to contract that surface down to a single point. And then locally near that point, what I have will look like a cone over that surface. This is analogous to the description of the A1 singularity that we described in some detail last time, where, as you saw directly from the coordinate description, it really looked like a cone over a curve, C, which had an equation yesterday like xy equals z squared, sitting inside of CP2. So by promoting x, y, and z to affine coordinates, we actually got this singular point, and then if you blew it up, you recovered the xy equals z squared as the exceptional set. We can try to do similar things here. The condition that we need in this case to contract a single surface down to a point, there is a good extension of Mumford's criterion in that case, and the condition that we need is that Ks should be negative. Well, actually, minus Ks must be ample. We had that terminology last time. And this is the definition of what's called a Telpezzo surface. And there's a classification of Delpezzo surfaces, but I don't have time to really tell you much about them today. Let me just say one example of one. For example, x cubed plus y cubed plus z cubed plus t cubed sitting inside of CP3, that describes a Delpezzo surface, or in the same spirit as up here, if I treat it as a, if I treat x, y, z, and t as affine coordinates, then I'll get a singularity, which is a cone over that surface, which is a canonical Bornstein singularity. I guess my fourth example is that flop, is the resolution of that flop. Sorry, it's hard to hear. Do it again. So this is number 4 right here. I can have a singularity like x y equals zt, which has a small so-called small resolution like this, where the isolated singular point is replaced by an isolated curve rather than by a surface. Or thought about the other way, this is a P1 whose normal bundle in X is O of minus, well, sorry, I never used this language before, but anyway, it's a vector, if you know what that means, you know what that means, you probably already know that this is a normal bundle. O of minus 1 plus O of minus 1. No, singularity, the Delpezzo surface is actually the exceptional divisor after you blow up. Singularity is at one point. And after you blow up, you get a Delpezzo surface. Okay, so those are some somewhat typical examples. They're not completely typical because I'm only contracting a very small set. I mean, only perhaps one component or example number 2 different kinds of things. Well, they're actually sweeping out an irreducible surface. So I'm really only contracting a single z in each of those cases that I mentioned. And when you start to put them together and combine them, as I say, you get a real zoo of examples. And although there's a kind of inductive strategy for giving a classification, some specific strategy in dimension 3 for blowing up one step at a time and analyzing what you get basically in these terms of whether you're getting a curved singularity or something that has a small blow-up or something that requires a big blow-up, that inductive strategy, there's no known way to sort of put together the combinatorics and say, okay, if we iterate this inductive strategy, we'll get the following list of singularities. Lists like that aren't known in this case. On the other hand, I mean, that sounds a little discouraging, but on the other hand, as in the case of K3 surfaces, for a specific type of Calabi-Yau manifold, there will be only a limited number of singularities that can occur on that specific type of Calabi-Yau manifold. And if it should be true, although part of my purpose at the end of the second lecture last week was to cast doubt on this common belief, but if it should be true that there really are only a finite number of different types of Calabi-Yau manifold, then there are only a finite number of different types of these singularities that ever have to be studied if you are just wanting to study string backgrounds. So the fact that we don't know a way to put together all the combinatorics is not an obstruction to, in principle, listing all the types of Calabi-Yau manifolds and all the singularities that are on them and analyzing all of them with a really big computer. Okay, so this is about the best we can do, or at least it's the first steps in the best that we can do, in that first approach to studying the canonical singularities. I want to go on to the other approaches, sort of describe where these things are going to sit in the moduli spaces, and look at them from these other points of view, such as monodromy or distance, finite distance from the singularities. And also the simultaneous resolution aspect. So simultaneous resolution turns out to be much too much to ask for in these cases, but you can ask for something a little bit weaker. So what we had with simultaneous resolution in the case of surfaces was a family of surface singularities which were obtained by varying the parameters, and we were able to blow up the family in some way which produced a non-singular surface in the middle. Now, in higher dimension, or in fact even in dimension 2, if you're not extremely careful about the way that you blow up the singularities, you can do a blow up which will produce for you in the central fiber perhaps a collection of several different surfaces meeting transversely. So the substitute is we're getting a collection of, well, they won't be surfaces now, they'll be higher dimensional manifolds, a collection of manifolds meeting transversely. In the central fiber. And because I don't have a lot of time, let me just explain briefly what's known as Hayakawa's criterion for deciding which threefold singularities are at finite distance from the interior of the moduli space. So Hayakawa's criterion actually applies to this L2 metric that's approximately the same as the physics metric and presumably is giving the right answer to the physics question of the physics metric. But it's conceivable that there's some that the non-perturbative corrections, well, not the non-perturbative, that the corrections to the naive metric would modify this statement somewhat in terms of physical applications, but at large volume of the Calabi-Yau manifold, this should be, the statement ought to be qualitatively correct, at least. So we're seeking for points in the moduli space which correspond to the Calabi-Yau manifold acquiring singularities, but we'd like those points to be at finite distance. So x sub 0 is at finite distance from, well, I should say that the point 0 is at finite distance from the point T. So let me label these as T and 0, 0 sitting on the singular locus somehow. If and only if a certain monodromy condition is satisfied, on the periods of xt as t approaches 0. And it's not quite finite monodromy, but It's a monodromy condition which guarantees that the holomorphic N form, or actually in this case holomorphic 3 form, continues to make sense. Limit. Many things can happen to your cohomology in limiting situations like this, and typically everything gets mixed up in the cohomology, and you might lose track of any individual form, but the condition that we need here is that the holomorphic 3 form, in an appropriate sense, continues to make sense in the limit, and that's true if and only if there is a weak simultaneous resolution of the sort that I mentioned. This is the family X, and this is the guy X sub 0, and out here are the guys X sub T. And then this will be a family called W, and that's W sub 0. In which W 0 is the union of a Calabi-Yau component, union with other threefolds, with no holomorphic 3 form. So the holomorphic 3 form belongs to the Calabi-Yau. In this case, the map from W0 to X0 is a resolution of singularities. And X0 has canonical Gorenstein singularities. So the situation for singularities in dimension 3 is considerably more complicated, as you can see. And let me just mention what happens with at least one of these examples. So in the flock case, well, let me give a more concrete example of flops in a more global context. Pardon? I'm sorry, W0, it's not W0, it's the Calabi-Yau. I didn't give it a name. It's this Calabi-Yau. That's basically correct. In the flop case, for example, if I take xy, maybe I should take xy plus zt is equal to epsilon, as opposed to xy plus zt is equal to 0, you need to do a base change. I didn't ever really tell you so much about what these weak simultaneous resolutions were. Anyway, this business of having to take a finite cover before doing the blow-up still applies. And if you do that and you blow up the resulting family, you end up with the small resolution of the Calabi-Yau meeting along this P1 some other space. There's just no avoiding the two components in this deal. In particular, unlike the case of K3 surfaces, I should back up one step to tell you one interesting episode in the history of K3 surfaces. So in the mid-50s, it was observed that this Coomer surface that you get by taking T4 mod Z2 had this resolution of singularities, replacing the points by curves, by S2s. And that had precisely the same Betty numbers as a non-singular quartic surface. In fact, you can embed this T-format Z2 in a natural way as a singular cortex surface. You can find cortex surfaces with 16 nodes. That was the original form in which Coomer discovered these, which is why they're called Coomer surfaces, 16 A1 singularities. And it was kind of a mystery as to why these Betti numbers were the same. So there's a paper written in 1955 by Spanier, who I believe was a student at the time, who worked out that the Betti numbers were the same. And then Atiyah, a couple of years later, gave an explanation for why they were the same in terms of this simultaneous resolution phenomenon. However, when you compare the Calabi-Yau manifolds that you get by looking at x of t in this picture, or the Calabi-Yau, which was the resolution of singularities of x of 0, the Betti numbers have changed. If there had been a simultaneous resolution in that stronger sense, I would have had diffeomorphic fibers, and I would have not had any option other than the Betti numbers not changing. So the Betti numbers, the change in the Betti numbers can be measured by the topology of this other surface that you have to put in, if you like. And you can actually extract even more information out of the picture than that. So we have to settle for this, if we want to describe the resolution, we have to settle for this more complicated picture with additional components, but still one Calabi-Yau component surviving. And you can pick out what its Hodge structure is by analyzing the monodromy, because the surviving part of the monodromy is going to be the Hodge structure of the Calabi-Yau that survived once you've taken a finite cover. So it's you have to throw away the finite part of the monodromy action. That's what I was kind of doing here. But aside from that complication, you can pick out the part of the Calabi-Yau that survives in exactly this form. Now, the picture in physics is that this gives natural connections between different Calabi-Yau moduli spaces. In fact, that picture can even be seen in mathematics if you're willing to include these extra ingredients of a Kähler class and a B field, because the second Betti number typically has gone down in such a process, right? When we're shrinking down curves like these Z's that I was discussing, the cohomology classes that were carried by the fibers of that contraction map are not present if you smooth out the surface to a nearby surface. So that's another distinction from the K3 case. There was this sort of trade-off between cohomology classes in the K3 case, where the ones that you were interpreting as blowdowns turned into new deformation classes, and there was the same number in both cases, and everything miraculously canceled out. That doesn't happen here. You have different types of moduli spaces, and if you're including both Kähler and complex moduli, you get a reduction. When you go to one of these places and do the blow-up, you get an increase in the number of Kähler parameters corresponding to a reduction in the number of complex parameters, and you actually have a completely different component of the Calabi-Yau moduli space, which is then glued onto the one you started out with. Well, I was going to tell you more details about flops, but I think I've probably exhausted your patience with the slight rambling nature at the end of the lecture, and I'll just quit there. So there are two kinds of moduli. There are the set of complex structures, and then there's the so-called complexified Kähler moduli. And the complexified Kähler moduli you describe as, in so-called semi-classical approximation, you describe as the Kähler cone, well, you describe as the second real cohomology plus I times the Kähler cone of the manifold, and then you have to mod out by the second integer cohomology acting on that. However, in physics, this description, this semi-classical description of the space is subject to corrections. So this is only a local description near the point that you're starting with. And the method that people have for analyzing this physics moduli space more globally, is to invoke mirror symmetry to find a mirror Calabi-Yau manifold and to identify this space with a neighborhood of a certain boundary point in the complex structure moduli space of the mirror manifold, and then use that space of the mirror manifold as a more global definition of the moduli space. So mathematically, there's really only an indirect way of studying this space, and you can only study it locally near certain limit points. But if you invoke this mirror symmetry idea, then the total moduli space looks like complex structures of X together with complex structures of a mirror. There's a trade-off here, as I mentioned, between the number of complex structure parameters decreasing and the number of Kähler parameters increasing. And if you look at the mirror of this picture, that trade-off is reversed. So the mirror of this manifold will also have a transition to the mirror of this manifold, but it will go in the other direction.